We're joined today in our fifth property patter by Guy Featherstone Hall QC and Gavin Bennison of Falcon Chambers, as well as one of my colleagues in our property litigation team here at Charles Russell Speechleys, Laura Bushaway. My name is Emma Humphreys, and the plan today is to look ahead to 2020 and some of the cases we are expecting to see. Guy, of course, undertakes an informal survey of his fellow members of Chambers each year to see what they've been working on, and from what he tells me, all of us involved in the property world should have another interesting year ahead.
So Guy, from your discussions in Chambers, I understand we've got at least one case which follows on from the Ground F decision in S. Francis, which I believe is Kendall Street No. 3 Limited against Dejan Investments. Is that basically a rerun of S. Francis? Do we think there could be a different outcome?
It's not really a rerun. The main thing which it has explored and will explore in the Court of Appeal, unless it settles, is what happens where a landlord shows it intends to do sufficiently substantial works, absolutely genuinely intends to do them, but if the tenant left voluntarily, wouldn't do them straight away, but would wait for it to catch up with other works it plans to do. So it's a timing thing. And what the tenant was trying to argue in Kendall was, if I left voluntarily, you just wouldn't do the works that you say you're going to do there and then. You'd wait. And that doesn't engage Section 31F. Now, it's a very interesting point. It's not really covered by Francis itself. Francis was all about, would you do the works even if the tenant left? And here the landlord says, well, I would. It's a timing issue instead, and it's very hard to predict the outcome. I've listened to the arguments on both sides. They're really very interesting.
And as you say, it's more of a timing thing, really, isn't it? And I hear we've got another interesting case which may touch on S. Francis, Riley's Sports Bars and CGW Snooker, which I believe is looking at whether the same approach should be taken to analysing a landlord's intention when it comes to Ground G. Gavin?
I do think, Emma, that case will be decided the same way as Francis was. By way of reminder for us all, Ground G is one of the grounds in Section 30 of the 54 Act on which a landlord is entitled to oppose the renewal of a business tenancy. It's worded that the landlord must have an intention to occupy the holding for the purposes or partly for the purposes of a business. That seems to me to be very similar to the wording that the Supreme Court focused on in Francis, that the landlord must intend under Ground F to demolish or reconstruct the premises. And therefore, it seems to me that the court is very likely to take the same approach to analyse the landlord's intention as it did in Francis. What I mean by that is that it will reject that it's sufficient to have a conditional intention whereby, if the tenant were to give up possession prior to the hearing, the landlord would not proceed to carry out the works. And I don't see anything different in the wording of Ground G, really, that makes a case for compellingly for a different result.
And funnily enough, Ember, when we were arguing Francis and the Supreme Court, one of the arguments we put forward was, if you allow this approach to Ground F, it'll have to be applied to Ground G as well.
Yes.
So it's quite interesting what Gavin's just said.
And that's exactly right, isn't it? I mean, people are going to pick up a point about intention on Ground F, you know, about redevelopment cases, which we see a lot of course. Ground G is less common, certainly across our desks. It happens, but it's by no means as frequent as the Ground F queries. But that must, you know, it's just inevitable, isn't it, that people are going to start taking the same sort of line of argument, although I do love the way us lawyers always manage to find some different.
There is one point, actually, interestingly, that Lord Sumption focused on in Francis, which is points to a difference between Ground F and Ground G. There is some wording in Ground F that the landlord must not reasonably be able to do the works without obtaining possession of the holding. And Lord Sumption said that indicated that the landlord's intention must be being obstructed by the tenant's continued possession. Now, that wording is absent from Ground G, and then therefore you can see that an argument might be founded on that basis and say that Ground G should be applied differently. But I don't actually think, when one steps back, that that's either particularly fundamental to the reasoning in Francis or particularly likely to sway the court in interpreting Ground G in this case.
It's funny, but when I was a very junior baby in Chambers, I had a Ground G case. I remember a mate in Chambers saying to me when I was fretting about it, he said, look, nobody ever loses a Ground G case for a landlord. Well, it might start happening.
You never know.
Of course, S. Francis has been applied in the recent electronics communications code case of Ian Chichester. So it'll be interesting to see how Francis will be applied going forward in other contexts as well.
Yeah, I'm sure that's going to be true. I'm sure S. Francis is one of those cases we're just going to find crops up time and again, aren't we now?
Yeah.
And changing the subject, another interesting arena where we're going to be seeing, I think, some more cases in 2020, of course, is Section 84 of the Law of Property Act 1925. For our listeners, this section allows a party to apply to the tribunal to discharge or modify a restrictive covenant if certain hurdles are met. Now, Guy and I are on opposing sides of a case, so we can't really comment on one of the cases which is coming up, but ignoring the potential outcome of the cases that we may see. I have to say, I personally feel as if the cases are going in a direction where it looks like it's becoming easier to persuade the tribunal to relax covenants, or do we just think the better cases are going before the tribunal? I don't know. Laura, what do you think?
Emma, I don't know whether we can say that it's becoming easier to persuade the upper tribunal to modify or discharge covenants, but the trend in 2019 did seem to point towards an increase in applications, and a lot of those applications were granted in whole or in part. For example, just recently in Berkeley Square against Berkeley Square Holdings, the upper tribunal granted an application to modify a restrictive covenant that premises be used as an office on grounds that use was obsolete. The applicant wanted to convert the premises into a private members club with restaurants, bars and a private dining room, and had planning permission to do so. But in reaching its decision, the upper tribunal emphasised that each case will turn on its own facts. It also said that the focus must be on the statutory grounds and whether the applicant has satisfied the upper tribunal on the balance of probabilities that one or more grounds for modification have been made out. Also, earlier in the year, we had the decision in Chavram Normandy Limited and Basingstoke and Deanborough Council. And in that case, the Upper Tribunal discharged a covenant in a lease restricting use to offices. The applicant had wanted to convert the office block near Basingstoke Railway Station into residential flats, and the Upper Tribunal was not convinced that the retention of office use would make a significant contribution to the economic well-being of the town. So Ground AA was made out. In 2020, we will see the Supreme Court considering the restrictive covenants case of Alexander Devine against Housing Solutions Limited. The Court of Appeal determined that restrictive covenants should not be modified to permit a residential development where houses were built in breach of the restrictive covenant on grounds that it was contrary to the public interest. So it's going to be interesting to see what the Supreme Court decides in that case.
Yeah, I think we're all looking forward to reading that judgment. I think it's going to be a very interesting one, isn't it? Do you find more Section 84 cases crossing your desk? I mean, we certainly see the judgments.
There is a slight sense, Emma, amongst myself and my colleagues, I think, that although the number of cases might be similar, it is perhaps a little easier to persuade the tribunal to relax covenants. That's purely from our own experience in our own cases over the course of this year, and I don't know whether it's necessarily the case more generally, but there does seem to be a sense that there's a trend in that direction.
Yeah, it may just be awareness as well, mightn't it? I mean, you know, the more you see these cases come out, the more aware people are of them. I know I get, you know, queries from people who've seen, you know, an article or what have you about it and didn't know it existed, and then they think, oh, might that help me with my development? So it might just be aware.
I think you're right, Emma. How many cons have we taken part in about Section 84? Quite often, when you say, well, there's always Section 84, people look mildly surprised, don't they?
They do.
I've noticed a trend towards more flexibility on the part of the upper tribunal. And for years, we had a trickle of cases all about, can I stick another house in the back garden? Now it's all much more adventurous. You know, it's, can I get my long lease modified? You know, all sorts of really quite interesting things. And funnily enough, I was having a chat with the deputy president, unrelated to any of this, about 6 months ago, and he said, I understand there's a perception that the tribunal is more willing to relax covenants, and I have to say that we don't share that at all. You know, that's interesting. That's interesting. Their take, and it's not my take at all.
Yeah. Well, maybe people are just being better advised. Maybe they're just running the winning ones. Who knows? Who knows? And changing topic again, a topic very which I'm always very interested in. We have, of course, seen a lot of cases examining the appropriate interpretation of the Electronic Communications Code since it was introduced at the end of 2017. I understand there's been an application in CTIL and Ashlock for the case to be leapfrogged to the Supreme Court on one of the questions there, and Compton Beauchamp also may be appealed to Supreme Court as well. So, you know, do we think there are any signs that operators and or landowners may be wearying of all this litigation, or do we have too many issues yet to explore? Gavin, what do you think?
I think there are lots of issues still to explore under the new code, and that's in a way quite interesting because under the old code the situation was quite different. If we remember, under the old code there were many issues which were ripe for exploration but which both landowners and operators preferred remain unanswered and therefore didn't bring before the courts. The landscape is quite different under the new code in that we've seen really the phase of ironing out new terminology continue apace. I think that's because there are quite a lot of terms which are in the new code but which don't have their roots in centuries of property case law, such as the concept of occupation, and therefore we need to become more familiar with that. There's also an important issue yet to be really addressed at all by the tribunal, which is how valuation should be approached. I'm aware that as between landowners and operators, there is in many instances a difference of opinion in negotiations as to the basis on which the new code directs that valuation should be undertaken. Those are disputes which currently seem to be being ironed out without bringing matters before the tribunal, but which I think may well come before the tribunal in due course. So I do think that actually there is quite a lot that's yet to come.
I think the problem is, you know, as we saw in Compton Beauchamp, you know, if operators are going to offer £2.96 per annum in rent, then probably there's going to be some litigation. And as you say, I mean, I've heard about various cases where, you know, this valuation, these various valuation points are still yet to be argued. So I think that's, you know, probably, hopefully, we'll see those issues bottomed out a bit in 2020. And maybe that will then lead to less of the current fighting. I don't know. They're very fundamentally opposed, aren't they, on many issues?
Yes. And the other sea change, of course, is that in the old days, we had the county court dealing with
yes.
stuff. And most people, given the lottery that you get with a different county court judge who may have no idea, who's never heard of the old code, that people didn't litigate. Whereas now we have a very, very clever, confident bunch of judges in the upper tribunal who are absolutely vested in the new code. They know how it works and they believe in getting out their judgments very, very quickly. Indeed, they're required to under the legislation. So that's made a big difference.
It has. I mean, it, you know, in that sense, which, you know, whichever side of the fence people sit on with these arguments, you know, you can't fault the tribunal for its efficiency and, you know, its understanding of the code. But, you know, it's a very complex piece of legislation. And as you say, you know, when it, on the rare occasions it went before the county court, it was commented on and by Lewis, wasn't it, about what a horrendous bit of drafting the old code was. And so we are very lucky to have eminent lawyers who are applying this legislation and, you know, the consistency as well. I mean, that's the other thing, isn't it? You know, very rarely do you get that level of consistency at the lower end of decision making. So we do have much to be thankful for, even if it doesn't always feel like it. But is it, one thing I found quite interesting in the last few years is actually the reduction in cases where rights of light are involved. You know, we had a, you know, nothing but rights of light, it felt like, for a while, or perhaps it was just they were so kind of, the impact of those cases was so great, perhaps, rather than the number. But I see, Guy, that we're awaiting a judgment in one rights of light case next year, Beaumont Business Centres and Florala Properties. Have you seen less rights of light cases coming across your desks, or is it just that developers are now more aware of the importance of taking advice at an early stage, and are they perhaps just now more cautious when they're dealing with neighbours? Guy, what have you found during this year, last year?
Definitely less, and I think the reason for that is the decision of the Supreme Court in Coventry and Lawrence, which just took all the law as we understood it to be, you know, with courts applying the Shelfer principles. We all knew where we were. We could explain those to a client and say, well, your chances don't look very good, because that was all ripped up and thrown into the air by Lord Neuberger and co. And now it's much more difficult to advise, and it's a bit pathetic sitting in front of the client saying, well, you know, it might happen, it might not. And I think we've seen a tiny trickle of rights of life and general property rights in junction cases since Coventry and Lawrence. And it's only where you've got, as in Beaumont and Florala, two well-resourced clients who are determined to have it out in court that it stands any chance of seeing the light of day, no pun intended. And it'd be very interesting to see what the judge does in that case. I mean, the other thing worth mentioning, since we've been talking about how good the upper tribunal is, if the upper tribunal could also deal with these property rights injunction cases, I just think there'd be no problem. They would then get expert in that field too, whereas the Florala case was just assigned to a deputy high court judge whose practice had absolutely nothing to do with property. Actually, he was brilliant in court, but there's much more of a lottery with these cases. Yeah. You don't know who you're going to get. When you get somebody, you might have nothing to do with property at all. So it's not like going to the upper tribunal where you have all that consistency of expertise and the rest of it. So that may be a reason why it's not litigated.
It's something which I think, it's getting increasingly unacceptable in my view. It costs a lot of money to take a case to trial, and to have the prospect that case, which, obviously was what we do, will be all about property, to perhaps be determined by, let's say, someone who was a family lawyer and has never heard of the Landlord and Tenant Act 1954, for example, no criticism of their own, decision making, but it's like me trying to decide on a family case, really, without any of the background understanding. And I know that's how our system seems to think it's a good way of working, but I think clients find it very hard to understand that their decision is going to be made by someone who might not have that knowledge, which I can fully understand.
Completely agree. I get really cross about this. When Geoffrey Voss invented the property and business course to replace chancery division, so that everybody would know what that meant. And he then, in the first incarnation, didn't even have a property thing on the drop-down menu. When I asked him about that, he said, it's because we don't really see property in the High Court. And he's dead right. And the reason for that is they get rid of it to the county courts.
Yeah.
I've never understood why. I mean, property cases are terribly important. Yes. And they often involve a huge amount of money.
Yes, they do. They do. And they're important. Yep. They are. No, it's quite funny, isn't it? And I think you're right, Coventry and Lawrence, definitely the way we had to advise people once that decision came out. I think prior to that, certainly people whose rights of life were being infringed were giving, they were getting quite bullish advice and they were feeling quite kind of punchy about their rights. And then Coventry and Lawrence came out and everyone's had to be a little bit more cautious, haven't they? Which is no bad thing, actually.
No.
In terms of getting people to actually negotiate a sensible settlement. Okay, well, I thought actually to finish up, I thought we'd touch on a case which we've been talking about a lot in our team, haven't we, which is Duval and 11 to 13 Randolph Crescent. Now, that's a case where the Court of Appeal found that a landlord would be in breach of its obligations if it permitted tenant alterations despite the presence of an absolute covenant in the lease against such works. Now, none of us here, I believe, are involved with this case, so I thought we might make a bit of a prediction as to how the Supreme Court decide the position here. Laura, as you've been the one kindly briefing our team constantly on every development in this case, do you want to start? Where do you think it's going to end up?
Well, Emma, I have been following this decision very closely. In the lower courts, the decision has gone both ways, twice in favour of Dr. Duval, and including most recently in the Court of Appeal, and once for the landlord. Based on the Court of Appeal's reasoning, it is difficult to see how the Supreme Court could reach a different decision, but I think landlords will want the Supreme Court to overturn the Court of Appeal's decision, and the result is eagerly anticipated because I think before Duval, it was not generally thought that a landlord would be in breach of any of its covenants in a lease by granting permission to a tenant to do something which was absolutely prohibited. So we'll have to wait and see if the Supreme Court overturns the Court of Appeal's decision later this year.
It's going to be interesting. Gavin, what are your predictions on that one?
I think I certainly agree with Laura that it's difficult to see how the Supreme Court will take a different approach from the Court of Appeal in this case. Duval was definitely a difficult and unusual case, but I think Lord Justice Lewison's reasoning is very tight and very solid, and it focuses on admittedly some quite old case law, but I think does so in quite a convincing way. perhaps an opportunity might arise for the Supreme Court to go for a sort of halfway house, whereby it finds that a landlord is only able to grant a waiver or consent for what would otherwise be a breach of covenant if the lessee has not yet requested that the landlord enforce that covenant. In the Court of Appeal, Lord Justice Lewison had said it didn't matter whether the requests were made before or after the consent, i.e. whether the landlord or the tenant acted first. The landlord still couldn't waive what would otherwise be an absolute breach of covenant. As I say, I think the Supreme Court might change that a little bit, but fundamentally I think it will uphold the reasoning of the Court of Appeal.
What are your thoughts, Guy?
I always think when I read the judgment of Justice Lewison that it's right, because I think he's the cleverest man on the bench. I really do. He's fantastic. And I agree with his reasoning. That doesn't mean it won't be upset by the Supreme Court. It's very interesting. The real property guy in the Supreme Court sitting on this is Lord Carnworth. But there's this tendency I've noticed in the Supreme Court for them to try and out-clever the clever boy below. And there might be a bit of that going on. Interestingly, another man sitting on the panel is Lord Sales, who was the man in the Court of Appeal who decided the Section 84 case, which is now going to be heard in the Supreme Court, obviously without him on the panel. And I suspect that he will be shown to have been wrong in his judgment on the Court of Appeal. So in this property case, Duval, I suspect we won't hear very much from him. And it will all come down to whether Lord Carnworth thinks Lord Justice Lewison got it wrong. I don't think he will, but I just don't think it's very hard to call it.
It's very hard to call it, isn't it? Yeah. It's funny, I take the view you take. My sort of sense is I feel like this needs some tweaking. But, you know, every time I read one of Lord Justice Lewison's judgments, I'm just, you know, frankly, absolutely grateful that we have him in the Court of Appeal. When I think of some of the tragic Court of Appeal decisions that we had in the past before he was in the Court of Appeal deciding on property cases, you know, I'm just so grateful that he's there. Finally, a Court of Appeal judge who really gets property. And, you know, and thank goodness, really. But, yeah, so that's my hesitation as well. I just think I wouldn't like to say anything different to him.
But if you look at the record of Supreme Court appeals from Lewison judgments, he doesn't do well, and I really can't detect the reason for that, because I always think he's right.
Yeah.
But it might be down to trying to out-clever the clever boy. It might be. You know, it'd be awful if it were, but you can't help feeling that sometimes.
So thank you all so much for your time today. We certainly seem to have an interesting year ahead. To our listeners, please don't forget to read Guy's EG article, which will give you some more details about the cases we're likely to see in 2020. In the meantime, we wish you all the very best for a healthy and happy new year.